So it, okay, she's at a brand. She was cool. She's acting together at 4716 in Naples, Florida. He was in stuff. At a branch 825 in Oak Brook, Illinois, she's probably got the most experience within the NALC, going to different trainings and stuff, but she's also worked with a lot of women's groups outside. And any woman will tell you that in the NALC, it's an old boys club. There are a lot of women in good positions here, but there's not enough women. And I've learned so much from Margo just in her talking about like women's issues and stuff that I would have never thought about. Things that everyone in our union should know about, right? And Margo and Sarah work on that stuff in amazing ways. And then there's myself. I'm just a dirty street cat. I've been working. I've been doing community organizing for the better part of 20 years. I've done community, political, social justice stuff. I built mutual aid programs on accident half the time. I feed homeless people with food, not bombs. Like, I am in the community. I love that about this. And that's why I want to stick around. And then we have Joshua Town, who he's newer to organizing, right? But he's at Branch 55 in Rhode Island. He's newer to this stuff, but I put him into contact with some people, some AFSCME employees, people in the TSA, and he's built relationships with them. He's given them a platform. We had an issue where there was my buddy Johnny Jones, who's a TSA cat. When they were all furloughed, not making any money, he went to Capitol Hill to talk to Congress to try and get them paid. But because of the relationship he built with Joshua Town, who's a new cat to this, he started advocating for letter carrier issues on Capitol Hill. He didn't have to do that. He was trying to get his membership paid. Do you understand how important it is to have somebody who is in the fight? No one asked him to do that. But he was putting those people on Congress on the spot. While I'm here getting my people paid, I want to talk to you about my friends in the letter carriers union. Do you understand how beautiful and important and how powerful that is? Our union doesn't do this. Our union does office-to-office stuff, and that's important. But they're missing a key element of being involved in and getting wins from the labor movement of 2026.
There's power in the factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand there.
You're listening to Working Voices on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Edmund DeVore is a letter carrier who belongs to the National Association of Letter Carriers. Last week, he attended his first NALC conference in Los Angeles, where they met from August 3rd through August 7th. He attended classes and hoped issues like a living wage for letter carriers would get support.
Please introduce yourself, sir.
Edmund DeVore.
And Edmund DeVore, who do you represent?
Well, I'm rank and file carrier. I represent them. I'm actually out of Branch 24, and we're the host of this convention that's happening right now.
And just give us an idea of the kind of resolutions that you're considering.
Obviously, there is the 30 for 30, which is what's being held tonight. You know, it's the starting wage should be $30 an hour. That absolutely is very important to have to get that started.
Why does the wage start? You said the starting wage used to be like $30 an hour. Why is that?
Well, when I first started out, just a little background on myself. I started out almost like 18 years ago, and I started out as a casual, and then I went to TE, and then down to CCA. And when I say down, the TE position, we were getting paid $22 an hour. And this is back in like 2009, I believe, and 2010. My memory's a little bit foggy with that, but that's the starting wage the carriers are making now. That doesn't make any sense. And we're what, 16 years later, and it's still that? You know, it's ludicrous, if you ask me.
What's it like living on that wage?
I can tell you from my CCAs that go into my office, it's hard on them. They have to work a lot to survive. It's like it's that whole quota of, you know, we want to work so we can live. Well, it's the society, it's we have to live to work. It's backwards.
What do your coworkers go through? Making how much are they making an hour usually?
A starting wage for them, the CCAs, it's about 22, and they struggle. They have to have roommates. I know some of them have other jobs, and you can see kind of just the look on their face of defeat. Here we are, we're coming in to work, and the paycheck comes in, the paycheck goes. There's no room for saving, no room for investing their money. They have to take what they have and, hopefully survive off of it.
And how long can your days be?
I was working, 12 hours a day, and that was a norm. That was the normal. Oh, you work 12 hours, or and if I ended up working 10 hours, oh, that was a short day.
How, what do you expect for the holidays and election season when you're going to have a lot of mailers and a lot of packages and
Way I look at it, this income for us.
A CCA is a new hire, right? Or a newer hire?
Correct. It's CCA stands for City Carrier Assistant. It's basically the position was designed as a non-career position to assist the workforce.
But it seems like they're getting the lower.
And it's to offset the cost. So the more CCAs, the higher, the more work they're going to give the CCAs.
So it sounds like this resolution regarding wages sounds really important.
It is.
Okay. What's it like being in, what's it like, your first time at this convention? What do you think?
I'm taking it all in. It's very moving. I met somebody from Rhode Island today. I'm California. It's just having that. We're all coming together from all places across the country, and we're coming in and we're gathering as one. And it's just nice. I mean, it's just nice to see unity. At least that's what I saw tonight. I know we all differ on opinions as far as maybe someone who we want to elect for or not, but at the end of the day, we want a better union for ourselves.
Is there any, if people are interested in the NALC or anything related to that, what websites or where can they go to?
Well, there's I'm going to tell you right now, there's many podcasts that I listen to that really kind of spread the word as far as getting to know the union or whatnot. Some are strictly educational, some are a mix of both. But the one you kind of got to focus on right now is the Building and Fighting NALC, which what they're doing is now that's I just said it right there. It speaks for itself, and they get on how we can build a better NALC. But again, there's other podcasts out there like Classes of Mail. They do both educational and political, from A to Arbitration, also Parcels of Knowledge. I mean, just to name a few right there. So that those are avenues they can go down. I mean, you don't have to agree with all of them, but it's just hearing maybe what's going on in our NALC.
Can you give a shout out to the first podcast you mentioned?
Shout out to Building and Fighting NALC.
For more information, go to nextgenerationcarriers.com and NALC.org. Jamie Partridge is a retired letter carrier in Portland, Oregon, who tries to protect his community against ICE kidnappings. He was hoping that his union, NALC, would support a resolution to stand against ICE during their convention in LA last week.
You're listening to Working Voices on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
And I am interviewing
Jamie Partridge.
And who are you with, Jamie?
I'm with the National Association of Letter Carriers, the Mail Carriers Union. We're here in Los Angeles for our national convention. We're with 5,000 letter carriers talking about how to change our working conditions and improve the conditions of our communities.
And where are you from?
Portland, Oregon.
What do you hope gets done at this convention?
Well, one of the main resolutions that we're going to be talking about is one called declaring ourselves a sanctuary union. It's a resolution that I wrote and that we passed at my branch in Portland, and that I'm trying to spread around the country. That is to point out the particular position that letter carriers are in. That is, we're on every street every day, and we can be the eyes and ears of ICE activity, immigration and customs enforcement activity in our neighborhoods, and we can help defend people against the brutalization that ICE is enacting in our communities. One of the ways to do that, of course, is calling. We have a rapid response hotline, Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition hotline, which then activates people to come out immediately to be witnesses, to be legal observers, to be legal advice, and to protest ICE activity. And we're trying to spread the word among letter carriers that we should take on this responsibility.
And why did you write this resolution?
I wrote the resolution, but it's because of my involvement with the immigrant communities that I deliver mail to, right? And just seeing what an impact the whole surge of ICE activity has been in the last, whatever it's been, you know, the last couple of years, that it's just terrorized the people that we deliver mail to. I mean, people are afraid of leaving their homes. People are afraid of taking their kids to school. People are afraid of going to the store, the shop, or going to work. And we see this. I mean, we're in communities and we know the people that we deliver their mail. And we, you know, we feel concerned and want to do something for our neighbors and, the people that we serve.
So what have you observed on your routes ever since I started doing their abductions in Portland?
Well, I am a retired letter carrier, so I'm have a lot of flexibility to be. I'm a rapid responder myself, so that I get calls from our hotline when there is ICE activity, and I can go out and be a legal observer or can be part of a protest. Many friends from years of being a letter carrier in my neighborhood. So I still see the people that I used to deliver their mail, and have just a number of people that have been picked up by ICE and are in detention, and just see how horrific it is that the way people are being treated. I mean, basically, doesn't matter whether you have documentation or not. If you got brown skin, you're fair game for ICE. And people are being refused legal access. They're being hustled off to the detention centers and then kept in horrific conditions until they agree to self-deport, basically. And I've seen this happen to some of my friends that, they don't have access to lawyers. They don't have access to any legal process to, argue for asylum or anything. So it's an important thing for me personally, but also just I understand that we have a particular role as letter carriers, and somebody who's very connected with the community of letter carriers, I feel a responsibility to use what power we have to defend and raise up this situation.
So you'd be like a sanctuary union or something?
We've declared ourselves a sanctuary union in that we've agreed that we're not going to cooperate to the extent possible by law with ICE agents, and that we're going to defend our members and their families and our customers who are subject to immigration enforcement. That's what we're going to be talking about here at the convention, to try to spread the word.
There's a lot of letter carriers who are immigrants, right?
Yeah, totally. We have non-citizen immigrants who have green cards, and these are the same. These people are getting picked up. These people are they're even going after people that have been naturalized.
How bad is it in Portland right now?
Well, it's not as bad as it is in the Valley, where the agriculture, where the farm workers are getting picked up all the time. I know people on their way to work.
Which valley? Central Valley in California?
I'm in Oregon's Willamette Valley, which is the main river that goes north-south in our state. And that's where the communities that are, you know, predominantly Latino, and that's where a lot of ice activity is happening. Yeah.
Jamie, I hear that you also have a show too. Do you want to talk about that?
I have a labor radio show on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. It's you can go to the website and we do all kinds of labor solidarity interviews, and of course try to bring in all the community and social issues, social justice issues that working people care about and need to know about.
This is Reggie Wong for this Working Voices update.
You've been listening to Reggie Wong with interviews from last week's NALC convention. To hear more of Jamie Partridge, you can go to kboo.fm.
'Cause nowhere is safe in this world of change. Consent is manufactured through bigotry and rage. So billionaires and fascists can rule without a fight. But the will can be broken if the people unite. But the will can be broken if the people unite.
This is Gary Oldman. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
In the next half of the hour this morning, our Working Voices executive producer, Dan McCrory, meets with Heidi Shearholtz, president of the Economic Policy Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank that serves working people. She is a leading voice for a worker-centered policy agenda who formerly served the Obama administration as chief economist at the Department of Labor.
This is Dan McCrory talking to Heidi Shearholtz of the Economic Policy Institute. And I understand you've got an anniversary this year.
Yes, we do. This is the Lordy, Lordy, look who's 40 year for EPI. EPI was founded in 1986. So that makes us 40 this year. It's sort of amazing how much time has passed, how much work has been done, the impact we've had.
I actually thought you'd been around a lot longer. Seems like the EPI has always been here.
Mm-hmm.
How did it get started?
So EPI was founded in the wake of the sort of avalanche of neoliberal approach to economics. So we started to see with, you know, it started a little bit in the 70s, but really entrenched when Reagan came to office of, you know, the idea that any interventions, minimum wages, unions, anything that we now know is something that is really important to make an economy that is fair, where not just fair, but where prosperity is broadly shared, where we actually generate strong growth, and that strong growth is broadly shared. Both things are important. And what we were seeing in the 80s was just this absolute just deluge of, in particular, economists coming out with report after report after paper saying things like minimum wages, you know, they may sound good on the face of it, but really they end up hurting exactly who you're trying to help, right? Because they cause job, like there were just, that's not true. The evidence is very, very clear that that is not what has happened with minimum wage increases. But there were just a ton of, there was just a ton of work coming out, quote unquote, showing those things. It was really influencing policy on both the right and the left. And there was nothing out there that was a counterbalance for that. And that's where EPI comes in. There was just a clear need to have a place that uses the tools of economics, can like play on that playing field to fight for economic justice for working people. It was incredibly important. I think EPI at the time, I think it has been really influential. It has shifted the debate. EPI has shifted the debate on many things. And we now see the economic, I don't think you can give all credit to EPI, but you can give some to EPI. The economics field has really shifted. You know, now the absolute weight of the evidence on the minimum wage is that increasing minimum wages raise wages for the lowest wage workers without causing job loss, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it has, we have had a big impact. So that's really exciting.
I was around during the Reagan years, and what I saw labor doing was keeping its head down and so and be able enough to bend without breaking.
Yeah, yeah. And there was, the attacks were just so relentless on not just on labor standards like minimum wages, but also on, I mean, on many, many fronts, right? But the attacks on labor unions have just been relentless. And the Ronald Reagan attacks on labor unions get a lot of play. But one of the things that did was just open the floodgates, right? It became a country where the president was, it is open season on unions and call, right? And we just saw massively increased aggressiveness against unions and then basically total policy neglect, right? On both the right and the left, we didn't see labor law be reformed in order to create a level playing field, in order to counterbalance that massive increase in employer aggressiveness against unions.
I know Reagan had been president of SAG, Screen Actors Guild, and I'm just wondering if you happen to know how he reconciled that with his new stance on labor.
I do not know the answer to that. I do not know the answer to that question. I wonder if there is anybody who actually has some, there could be people who have some facts on the ground for that, which I do not. His absolute, like, bloodlust for unions while president does make me question how devoted he was to unions in the earlier part of his career, but I do not know the specific answer to that.
Gotcha. So filling this void, was it labor that instigated the formation, and who was on board originally?
So the I should know this. The unions that formed EPI, I think that they were steelworker. Even by saying this, I'm not gonna say them. I'm gonna find them here so I don't leave people out. The founders of EPI were Robert Reich, who has had a great following in recent years. Barry Bluestone, Lester Thoreau, Jeff Foe was the founding president of EPI, and all are to some degree still involved in EPI to some extent, like in various ways. Oh, and I was just going to say, and it was absolutely founded by labor to begin with. Yeah, it's absolutely founded by labor to begin
with. Another thing that has bothered me since NAFTA was getting on board with NAFTA, including Robert Reich. I interviewed him.
Yeah, it's tricky. I don't know the answer to that for him personally. EPI has certainly been at the forefront of just pointing out just how damaging that was. And that was, I mean, right. I did say the thing about how the economics profession has changed. Now it's not the same economics profession that it was when EPI was started in the 80s and not in the 90s. I mean, it's not the same economics profession that it was 15 years ago, right? Like, it has evolved, but EPI was going up against essentially the entire economics profession in coming out in opposition to trade agreements like NAFTA that were so heavily weighted against workers that, you know, we knew what would happen, predicted what would happen, told everyone what would happen. People were like, no, trade is win-win. That was the sort of neoliberal logic that ruled the day. And they were proven wrong. Like, that is not what happened with NAFTA in any sense. And so those lessons are, I mean, you also saw Obama doing the same thing with TPP, right? Like, it was, so I do feel like that was what made me hesitate to say the lessons are now learned. But I do think that we're a little bit farther than we were when NAFTA was at play.
I agree. What kind of changes had to take place? Or was it something that swept the nation as far as opening eyes?
I think it's something about the research that has come out that has shown, I mean, to me, minimum wage it's easy to wrap your arms around and helps, like, phenomenon, the changing in the field that happened, not just around the minimum wage, but also around other things. And that was, if you look at like Econ 101 models, they basically say, if you raise the minimum wage, like and that was what, you know, people just said, nope, that we can't raise the minimum wage because it's going to cause job loss. It's going to hurt the very people you're trying to help. So that's what this sort of neoliberal theory says. And then people came in and actually started looking at it empirically. And that changed everything. Because when you look empirically, in this country, we have 50 states, a District of Columbia, and different localities that are all changing their minimum wages at different times. And so you can have situations where you have like two counties that are right next to each other that have very much like share a labor market. One county raises their minimum wage, the other county doesn't. And that is a little natural experiment right there. Raise their minimum wage compared to the place that didn't, because it's all like they face the same condition. And you do that rigorously all over the country, and the evidence is really clear. Like, you're raising wages for low-wage workers without causing meaningful job loss. And so that makes people go, okay, what's the one models, right? Like, how are we not true that the minimum wage causes job loss? Well, clear that it should. And what has come out is people have started to understand the absolutely bonkers assumption 101 models. So it is in the labor market, which I will just, like, that says the assumptions are perfect. If an employer puts wages out that are like 1 cent below the sort of quote unquote, immediately lose all of their workers, because their workers will immediately be able to find other jobs where they are paid fairly, and that original employer will go out of a business immediately. Like, everyone knows that's actually not how the labor market works. But honestly, it used to be the case where generally people in the field of economics believed that it was a close enough approximation to reality that they were fine having those assumptions like underlie their framework for how they think about the impact. I think that's really been broken to some extent. I mean, there are still people within the field that are fiercely holding on to it, right? But it's been, I think it definitely has cracks in this around that kind of thing.
So do you study microeconomics?
I'm trained as a microeconomist markets, but you in economics and you realize there is no whole lot from my macroeconomist colleagues, and, you know, know enough. But one thing is very, very clear. It's just everything is so.
I actually wrote a book in 2019. I didn't know what I was talking about, obviously, because I was just a union president. I got a call since this came out from a economist out of Herzegovina and all that, in his paper, that there was somebody that had a lot of the same ideas that he did. So I guess I can pat myself on the back as
totally
as a macro. But is there any bot as having grasped the situation at hand?
A lot of people who have written a lot of really good things, and I don't have one like seminal piece that I would point out. It is, and in this moment, the people doing the really great writing, it's also talking about sort of the intersection between and all. There's just so, we do absolutely, those who are writing things who are new, sort of new economic paradigm forward.
Was democracy and vice versa?
No, I think I'm sticking with capitalism. It is have really strong regulations in places where the, and so the country of the country actually isn't just captured by the people at the very top, but is from people. And I think from there, that protects democracy.
So what kind of subjects do you find yourself? Is there any talk about, for instance, a real benchmark of how things should be?
We talk a lot about, it's, you know, it's not easy to, as large and complicated as the U.S. economy does a really good job with one could do, and the edge of methodology and just really pushing forward. That is not to say it's perfect. And one thing that we're facing now is total attacks on the resources going to organizations like the Bureau of Labor Statistics and other government, U.S. government statistical agencies, which is really, really problematic. And I will step back and say the statistics that come out of, say, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the inflation rates, the unemployment rate, those kinds of statistics, I do not believe that they are being, that the administration is meddling in them and creating bias in those statistics. Like, I do not think that there's political meddling in the exact numbers. And the reason I don't think there is because each of those numbers literally takes hundreds of career servants who have devoted their lives to timely, accurate economic data. It requires hundreds of those to actually publish that. In order to meddle in those numbers, there's, like, in my mind, zero chance that we wouldn't have dozens and dozens of whistleblowers. Like, I think we would know if there was direct meddling. But that is not to say the administration isn't doing harm, because what they are doing is cutting resources. And that actually does really hurt the numbers over time, makes them more volatile, and the institutions, like, undermining people's trust in them. So it, there's a lot of highlighting just how unbelievably important and the damage that this administration is doing. It does indict a little bit former Trump agencies, because they are, like, the best in the world and have just done amazing work for decades, have not been investing in them at the level that we should have been even before Trump took office. So he took office, they were already really, they had already cut everything that they could. And so the additional cuts that he's done have caused real, real harm in those agencies.
What do you say when people say that you guys are just work is about?
Yes. I think that when EPI was first formed, it was, and I wasn't around then, but it, my understanding is that it was done on more of a sort of academic like model. And as the world that we operate in has evolved, it became clear that that is not going to be the way that we can really get our message out at all. Like, you need to not just do excellent, rigorous, top-notch research. You need to do the kinds of outreach and communications that make sure it gets in the hands of people who can actually use it on the ground to fight for economic justice. And so now when we do work, the actual rigorous, like, best in class kind of research we want to do, it feels like that is just the first step. And then, or maybe it's like the middle step, right? Like, we find out there's the first step of, like, working with groups on the ground, figuring out what is needed, and then doing the research, and then making sure it gets in the right hands. And in the media landscape, it's like, it's not just a 25-page paper that you drop into the ether, right? It becomes social media and blog posts and all the kinds of things that you need to do to get your ideas out there. So it's a much more complicated environment, I think, at this point that everyone is navigating, not just us.
It's successful in any regard if it's out there and people talk.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And that's one of the key goals of EPI is to really change the conversation, like affect the narrative, talk, you know, get people talking in a way that brings the interests of low and middle income people into economic policy debates, not just the stock market or the interests of the ultra wealthy. Like, this is about broadly shared prosperity. Economic policy should be about making sure everyone benefits.
That was Working Voices executive producer Dan McCrory in part one of his interview with Heidi Shierholz of the Economic Policy Institute. Part two of Dan's interview will run next week. And for more information about the Economic Policy Institute, you can find them at epi.org. That's epi.org.
We never get paid what our labor is worth. That's why we often in a daze on the way to our work. And when we get there, we can't wait to be out. So let me tell you what it's about.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
And finally, from the KPFK News Desk, Associate Producer Hal Lohr brings us this morning's Working Voices update.
The representative from California has the floor.
Sing out to the president.
Sad but true, one of the labor unions behind a controversial tax on California billionaires significantly scaled back its proposal a day after it qualified for the November ballot. But the offer last Thursday wasn't enough to get the governor on board. The proposal from the Service Employees International Union Healthcare Workers West to impose a one-time 5% tax on individuals whose net worth exceeds $1 billion faces staunch pushback from a wide swath of critics, including Governor Gavin Newsom. The union said Thursday it would abandon the 5% tax proposal if Newsom would join them in supporting a 2% levy. But Tara Gallegos, a spokesperson for Newsom, said scaling back a billionaire tax doesn't change its fundamental flaws that harm working Californians, whatever that means. And in her statement, she said, the governor supports making the wealthiest Americans pay their fair share, but this poorly designed state-only measure will somehow defund teachers, schools, clinics, and public safety. Because the tax to be paid by those living in the state as of January 1st, 2026, is meant to generate $100 billion in revenue, mainly to counter federal cuts to health care for low-income people, with some money going to food assistance and education programs. So according to the union, a 2% one-time tax on accumulated wealth is modest by any objective measure, especially if it means keeping emergency rooms open and saving patient lives. Secretary of State Shirley Weber said last Wednesday that petitioners had collected more than the roughly 875,000 signatures needed to place the original 5% proposal before the voters. And states have been debating how to respond to the major tax breaks and spending cut legislations Donald Trump signed last year. The 5% proposal has already divided lawmakers and major labor unions and triggered an expensive campaign to defeat it. The proposed tax is backed by prominent progressives, including Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Silicon Valley tech moguls, of course, have already spent millions of dollars to defeat it, and prominent players in Sacramento have opposed it. They include the California Medical Association, the California School Board Association, which helped launch a committee this week urging voters to reject it if it ends up on the ballot in November, and that's despite allegations that the associations never actually allowed their rank-and-file members to vote on the subject. And Gavin Newsom had already opposed the ballot measure
in 2022 to increase taxes on the wealthy, which would have funded programs that helped people buy electric cars or install more chargers. But the voters rejected it. Critics say the original measure would decrease state revenue over time by pushing the ultra-wealthy to leave, taking the money they would contribute in income taxes with them. That would deal a huge blow to a state that relies on its top 1% of earners for nearly half its personal income tax revenue. The nonpartisan Legislative Analysts Office estimates that the 5% tax would have generated tens of billions of dollars in the first few years, but that income tax revenues could subsequently decline by hundreds of millions of dollars annually. Since the proposal was announced in October, Google co-founder Sergey Brin had donated $82 million to a political committee with the rather Orwellian name Building a Better California, a committee that has raised more than $118 million, counting Brin's contributions, from fewer than a dozen donors, backing a variety of initiatives designed to blunt the billionaire tax proposal. Just as state lawmakers passed budget bills this week that aim to raise revenue in other ways, including by extending a tax on wealth care providers that nobody doubts will end up being passed down in the form of higher costs to working people.
And that's our show for this week. Once again, we're asking our labor partners, locals, and regional officers to seriously consider underwriting this show, because Working Voices and KPFK could really use your support. So please, contact the station at 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. Or go to kpfk.org to explore the possibilities. This is Hal Lohr sitting in for Joy Alla.
And this is Marissa Remsky.
And our thanks to Dan McCrory, Reggie Wong, Jerry Scott, and all our guests. And of course, always remember to educate, agitate, and organize.
Got so much work, yeah, yeah.
I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in, and especially thank those of you who pledged your support or renewed your membership to KPFK during this past fund drive. The support of generous listeners like you is what allows this listener-sponsored station to operate and to maintain its fierce independence. It's a very special relationship, so thank you once again for being a part of it.
The radio program Making Contact is now produced by KPFK and Pacifica Radio, and we're looking for volunteers to join our team. The station needs people who want to help book guests, conduct interviews, or script the show, especially bilingual English-Spanish speakers, people who have experience with audio editing, and someone who's skilled at enhancing interviews with archival footage, music, and sound effects. If you'd like to join this exciting transition and be a part of Making Contact's future, please email makingcontact@kpfk.org. That's makingcontact@kpfk.org.
Wilgear Theatricum Botanicum returns this June 6th through October 4th with outdoor repertory theater, events, and educational programs for all ages. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, alongside Romeo and Juliet, Treasure Island, Noel Coward's Waiting in the Wings, and Bernardo Cubría's dark and incisive new comedy of the 2025 Palisades, the 2025 Palisades Fire. Theatricum is located in Topanga Canyon, just off the